From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday the 13th of December, 2019. Hope you all have the best of luck today, and I hope we have some good luck on the program this morning. I think we are going to have a short show today. We're going to go live at 10 o'clock to CBS News coverage from Washington of resumption of deliberations in the House Judiciary Committee on the impeachment of President Donald Trump. But we do have our first hour guest that we had scheduled ready to go this morning, I do believe, and we're going to have Paul Heintz on from 7 Days giving us an update on his terrific recent coverage about the problems at the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility, Vermont's only women's prison, alleged to be rife with sexual misconduct by some members of the staff, as well as substance abuse by a few anyway, and other problems there, as well as just not a lot of oversight and responsiveness when people bring concerns and complaints to senior staff at the women's prison there in South Burlington. We'll be bringing Paul in just a moment after I tell you about our second half hour. Very interesting story developed involving a Vermont person this week, a man named Stanley Sloan, a 1961 graduate of Montpelier High School. Local guy makes good. He goes off and ends up being one of the world's leading experts on NATO and relations between the United States and Europe and between the Western Alliance that NATO is and then Soviet Union, now Russia. And anyway, Mr. Sloan was scheduled to be a speaker at a conference in Denmark this past Tuesday. He's been somewhat critical of President Trump on over issues related to NATO and how the president has handled his contacts with the other NATO nation leaders. And the U.S. ambassador to Denmark, Carlos Sands, announced recently that Mr. Sloan would not be speaking at this conference in Denmark. She withdrew/blocked his invitation there, and that prompted the Danish organizers of the conference to cancel the entire event. So this is apparently the Trump administration not wanting to brook any criticism and ending with a cancellation of an event on the future of NATO scheduled to have happened earlier this week in Denmark. Well, Stanley Sloan is a visiting scholar at Middlebury College, based here in Vermont, of course, and he is going to be a guest on the Dave Graham Show in the second half hour of the program this morning. You know, if you can't get your views out into a forum over there in Copenhagen, Denmark, we still have free speech rights here in Vermont, and we're going to hear what Mr. Sloan has to say in the second part of this short show today. But the first part I want to devote to this still unfolding story in Vermont that was really launched last week by Paul Heintz of 7 Days, and Paul Heintz is my guest. Good morning, Paul.
Hey, Dave. How's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good.
So tell me a little bit about the coverage that you were on our show last week talking about your sort of introductory story on this topic of real problems at the what used to be known as the Four C's, I guess back when the official name was the Chittenden County Correctional Center or something like that, but is now known as the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility. It's the Vermont's only women's prison, and it's rife with problems. And you give us a brief recap of what you found, what your initial reporting was, and then unroll for us a little bit what's happened since then.
Sure. So as we discussed last week, I was able to document quite a number of really horrific allegations involving both the Chittenden facility, but also a little bit more broadly, other parts of the Department of Corrections. And these range from alleged sexual assault within the facility, inappropriate and illegal relationships between DOC staffers and former inmates under DOC supervision outside of the prison, retaliation, you know, some pretty serious drug use by a shift supervisor at the prison. So there's a lot in there. It was, you know, like a 6,000 word cover story in last week's paper. In that story, we posted an email address and phone number for people to contact us with more information that they know about what's going on in the Department of Corrections. And we've gotten just a ton of tips since then. So I've been wading through those. And in this week's 7 Days, I had a story that sort of looks at what officials knew about these allegations prior to our reporting. And we were able to get our hands on quite a number of documents that show that a series of prison superintendents were aware of many of these complaints over the years, that current Commissioner of Corrections was aware of some of them. And then most surprising of all, I suppose, is that the Attorney General, T.J. Donovan, was also aware of some of them. And, you know, I want to be clear that not all these people knew everything.
Right.
But in Donovan's case, he met with two corrections officers, one current, one former, in, I believe, May of 2017. And they were considering suing the state because they said they faced pretty serious sexual harassment at Chittenden Regional and other parts of the Corrections Department. So they basically went to Donovan to lay out their allegations, and you know, I think they were trying to avoid having to file litigation, but also they say what they really wanted was for somebody to clean up the Department of Corrections. They thought that by bringing these allegations directly to the Attorney General, he might do something about them.
You know, this is actually a really interesting case, I think, of a tough conundrum for any attorney general, and which is as follows. A big part of their job is representing state agencies. They are the lawyer for the Department of Corrections, for example. And so, you know, that puts the attorney general duty-wise, doesn't it, in sort of a defensive posture relating to the Department of Corrections.
And so, oh yeah, no, totally. And what Donovan says is, you know, my job was to deal with this threat of litigation, and what I did was I settled the case quickly. I did it in a manner that didn't put the guards in the position of having to publicly fight this court battle for years. He thought it was a pretty good solution, I think, both for the state and for these guards. You know, they were expecting something more, and I think you do point out a challenge with this role of attorney general, right? They're, one of their jobs is to defend the state, to be the state's lawyer, but yep. The other one is to sort of be the you know, chief advocate in a way for the people, right? Chief legal advocate for the people. You see the same issue with the EB-5 case, right?
Yes, absolutely, and others.
You know, a lot of people want the attorney general to hold the state accountable for whatever it did wrong, if anything, in the EB-5 situation. But really, in that case, his job is to defend the state agencies in that case. So, you know, I think maybe the bigger question for me, though, is regardless of what his duties are on paper, if, you know, a top elected official in Vermont learns that there is, you know, there are ongoing allegations of sexual harassment within a state agency, perhaps that person ought to do a little bit more than settle the case. Perhaps after settling the case, that person could look into the situation more and try to address it. And I think there is some irony here because, as you know, Attorney General Donovan has a very, very expansive view of his powers as Attorney General.
Yes.
He just touches every issue he possibly can.
I don't want to let him off the hook at all. I don't mean to imply that.
Right.
I'm wondering, actually, did he go to Governor Phil Scott and say, hey, you're my client. I want to sit you down and talk to you about, you have a huge kettle of problems, you know, on the boil up in South Burlington here, and you better pay attention. Is there any indication he did that?
There is no indication that he talked to anybody about this. And I only know what he has told me, but I gave him and his office a couple of opportunities to respond to this, provide more information about his response. And they basically only pointed to his decision to settle this case. So it does not appear that he went to anybody or did anything to correct this problem.
That's weird. I mean, if I were him, in part to kind of cover himself and to put a little advanced Band-Aid on his own political future or whatever, because this stuff is going to come out someday, folks. When you see problems like this and you are in a senior level of government, you don't just hope it goes away, right?
Well, and I think that might be kind of a theme throughout this reporting. You know, a lot of this stuff I know that these allegations are a surprise to many people in Vermont, but to those who are working in the system, they're really not. I mean, the number of people I've talked to over the last week or so who've been like, duh, no kidding, this is happening.
Yeah, right, right.
Surprised me, right? Like, you know, I didn't really know, but we all sort of knew, right? Because, you know, April McCollum from the Burlington Free Press wrote a really great story a year ago about the plight of one of these guards that I've described here, Brittany Sweet. Mm-hmm. April was the first person, as far as I know, who reported on the allegations she made against the Department of Corrections. I read that story a year ago. I didn't do anything about it. You probably read that story. I don't know if you did anything about it. You know, we've all had some indications along the way. And, you know, we all bear some responsibility.
You're correct about that. Of course, then we have our elected officials who are the reason we put them there is to pick up the responsibility that we all bear. And if they're not doing that, or if they're not doing that very effectively, then that is certainly worth pointing out. And that's what journalism is for, folks. And you know, again, my hat is off to you, Paul, for really taking this ball down the field a long way here, and continuing to push over the past 10 days. You have not rested on your laurels. Tell us a little bit about the unfolding developments that you've had. I mean, sort of new revelations since your initial story.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, you had Secretary Smith on the show yesterday.
Yep.
Sort of the thing that I'm watching most closely right now is this. Secretary Smith has pledged to engage some sort of third-party investigator to really take a more thorough look at what happened here. And Smith wants it to be somebody outside of state government. He's said in recent days that he'd prefer it to be the federal government via the U.S. Attorney for the District of Vermont. So we may have some news on that later today, potentially. I'm curious to see where that goes.
Let me stop you there for a second, if I could, because that's so important, and you're right. Mike Smith, the Secretary of Human Services, whose agency, of course, includes the Department of Corrections, was on the Dave Graham Show here yesterday, and he was talking about this idea of setting up an outside entity to basically be a place for complaints about the internal workings of the Corrections Department to go and have them be addressed and resolved, et cetera. I think there's a long history here in a wide variety of different types of complaints within the Department of Corrections, where inmates are allowed to file a grievance, and there are grievance procedures for state staff to, you know, the under the union contract with state employees. And the real problem, though, is that these things tend to just go down the memory hole because you're essentially complaining about a system in which the people who are receiving complaints also work in the system. So
I'd love to sort of separate these two issues, because I think so. What I was just talking about is actually more an investigation into what happened.
Yeah, right?
And so this is I think really confusing, because there are like a ton of investigations around this. There's the Vermont State Police criminal investigation. There is Mike Smith's internal short term. He's calling it a review now, which he hopes to end by the end of next week with some recommendations to the governor. There is this additional investigation that he wants the federal government to take on, which I think would look at, you know, what has gone wrong at the prison or at the department more generally over the past few years. And then there is what I think you were just alluding to, which is what is going to be the ongoing system for people who are reporting complaints that happen now or in the future. And so that's another thing that Smith is working on. And he is establishing two different hotlines, one of which is for employee complaints. And that hotline would go to the Department of Human Resources, which is outside of the Agency of Human Services.
Yeah.
And so that number was set up yesterday. So employees who have something to report can use that hotline now. Separately, he's working on establishing a hotline for inmates to report abuse or misconduct of any kind. And I've got a story that should be on our website pretty soon, hopefully, that talks about what the system has been for reporting. And my reporting suggests that Vermont has actually not been in compliance with federal law, because federal law requires prisons to have a hotline for inmates that goes to an independent third party, so they can make a complaint and that complaint goes outside of the facility and will be sent back to the facility in some sort of anonymous fashion. So it's a way to protect people from retaliation. Vermont has not had that. Vermont has had a hotline for inmates, but the hotline just goes to the Department of Corrections central office, which, you know, you can see why that might be a problem, right? If you're experiencing some kind of abuse at the hands of prison officials, you don't want to report that to prison officials, right? So that is the challenge for Smith right now, is to find an outside entity who will actually take on that job. And according to the Department of Corrections officials I've spoken to, it's been difficult to find an outside body willing to actually do that work.
If you really need a responsive hotline, there's always 865-1020. That's the number for 7 days of Paul Hines, folks. And we also have just got a call in from Steve Howard of the Vermont State Employees Association. Obviously, among the players in this whole scene up there at the prison are a bunch of state employees who actually do the day-to-day work of providing correction officer services, et cetera. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
Good. You got to be quick here because we only have a couple of minutes left. But what's on your mind?
Well, I would like to say just a couple of things. I think it's really important to stress that the vast majority of correctional officers across the state, of course, are upstanding folks who respect and respect the rights of the folks who they are working with, the incarcerated population in the state. That needs to be said straightforwardly. But I also think we have to take a look at the Department of Human Resources and the role they played in the Department of Corrections and at Chittenden. What did they know? How much investigative work did they do? And I would also suggest that Secretary Smith and others look for another entity that that our members could call to report information other than the Department of Human Resources, somebody who is not attached to management, because I think that is probably going to be more successful in actually getting reports done than if you ask people to call the manager's Department of Human Resources.
Yeah, I mean, eventually, as I was only maybe one quarter joking before the break when I said, you know, the place to call is, I looked it up a moment ago, 865-1020, I think, a moment ago. That's the number for 7 days. And that's the, I mean...
Let me give you a different number.
Yeah, okay.
222-0363. That's our dedicated DOC reporting line. So 222-0363.
Yep. 03, okay, well, you don't want to flood your switchboard. That's okay. Okay, Paul, sorry about that. I didn't mean to cause you trouble. But I think, Steve, you make a good point, but I also think that eventually that kind of is the role of the media. You know, when you want to get outside of government, sometimes the place to call to get really, you know, pretty hard-hitting and tough and neutral and objective responses to problems within government structures is, you know, call your local call 7 days, you know, your local newspaper, call BT Digger, whoever, you know, you want to, but that the media play a crucial role here. And I just, you know, again, my hat's off to Paul for his work in this regard. So,
well, we are,
Dave, can I add something as well here?
Yes.
I just wanted to piggyback on what Steve was saying. Many of the complaints that I've been quoting from have been DOC employees who have been speaking out about this. One of the complaints in this week's story was from a VSCA union steward who spoke out about this years ago. The two women who went to Attorney General Donovan were guards at the facility. So he's right that many DOC employees have been.
Another good point. Unfortunately, we got to leave it there. So, Paul Hines of 7 Days, thanks so much for joining me this morning. Steve Howard, thank you for your call as well. Let's go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News. More of the Dave Graham Show to follow on a different topic. Stay with us, folks.
This is Jack from the Warren Store wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And we continue into the second half hour of our program this morning. It's Friday, the 13th of December, 2019. And my next guest is Stan Sloan. He's a 1961 graduate of Montpelier High School. A local boy makes good. He goes off into the world and becomes one of the a well-known international expert on NATO. He's a visiting scholar at Middlebury College. Spent some time with the CIA. And Stan Sloan was scheduled, from what we understand, to speak at a conference this week. I think it was scheduled for Tuesday in Denmark. And he was going to be talking about the future of NATO, the current status of NATO. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, of course, is the stalwart alliance, the Western alliance between Europe and the United States that has been the counterweight of the West to formerly the Soviet bloc and more recently Russia. And of course, we've had some strange goings on with Russia in recent years, given our current administration. The President of the United States has been quite critical of NATO, and many people have accused him of sort of undermining its fundamental purposes. And he, of course, takes the view that the United States has been too long the principal partner in terms of funding NATO and the military alliance in particular, that Europe hasn't done its share, and we need to get more out of our allies in Europe if anything along the lines of such an alliance is going to continue. So there's a lot going on, a lot of moving parts with NATO, and Stan Sloan was going to be speaking at this conference in Denmark. He has been somewhat critical of President Trump and President Trump's stances on NATO over recent years. All of a sudden, the ambassador to Denmark for the United States, a woman named Carla Sands, whose background, I guess, is as an actress and chiropractor from California, she's ambassador to Denmark, and she weighed in and said, "I don't really want this guy speaking at this conference in Denmark." And the Danish hosts of the conference then turned around and said, "Well, guess what? We're not going to have the conference. The whole thing's canceled." So. Weird events there in relation, especially in my estimation, to the whole idea of free speech and so on. We do still have free speech here in Vermont, and including on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And long story short, Stanley Sloan is my guest this morning here in the WDEV studio. Thanks for coming by, Mr. Sloan.
Dave, thanks for inviting me in.
So have I got the basic facts of that story about your invitation, disinvitation, and then the cancellation all right?
You do. The first reaction of the Danish Atlantic Council, who was the in-country sponsor for the event, was to let me know that I was off the program. Mm-hmm. And then there was a very strong reaction to that, and the next day they canceled the entire conference, partly because they thought it would become a debate about what had happened rather than about NATO, and they wanted to do something about NATO, and that's why I was invited.
Yeah, you know, I was saying to you last night, we were talking on the phone about your appearance here today, and I mean, one irony here is that if the ambassador to Denmark had not intervened and you had been allowed to speak at the conference just as planned and everything had gone off smoothly, how much play do you think the story would have gotten versus what it's getting now?
It would have gotten some local play because the local press media know something about me, know my views, and know that I have been critical of the president and his approach to NATO. Mm-hmm. And so it would have gotten some local press, and I think that probably would have been the end of it. But the action of the ambassador, and at this point we don't know whether she had guidance from Washington or not. The State Department apparently has said that he didn't give guidance along those lines. And some sources that I have in Denmark say that people at the embassy believe that they did have guidance. So we don't know whether it was her initiative or not. But in any case, it has become a huge story. And, you know, in some way, I think the Danish population and press were just waiting for something about this ambassador. I really think they feel disrespected getting an ambassador who apparently was appointed largely because she'd given several hundred thousand dollars to the Trump 2016 campaign.
Yeah, that apparently is an important qualification. If you look at, for instance, Gordon Sondland, who's the ambassador to the European Union, I think his primary qualification for such an important post in international relations was being a large donor to the Trump campaign too as well, right?
Yes, and this has happened with previous presidents as well, but mm-hmm. usually presidents try to appoint someone not only who was given to their campaign or supported them politically, but also someone who has some experience or contact to the country they're being appointed to.
Yeah.
And in this case, there was none of that.
And you know, I think that that is a balancing act. And I don't mean to pick on Trump exclusively about this, because you're right. Particularly to the smaller and more minor posts, you know, you think of some of the European capitals we hardly ever hear of. They tend to get ambassador appointments under many presidents who have been campaign donors and who have had maybe not they certainly haven't come up through the Foreign Service. Let's put it that way.
This certainly is true. The problem is, of course, Denmark is a very strong, important, small country, but NATO ally, sent mm-hmm. troops to Afghanistan, and they're a very loyal ally. And to treat them like this, I think they felt disrespected.
And you know, that actually is a point worth making, because you're right about Denmark. I mean, I do follow the history of I happen to be of Danish heritage myself, so I sort of follow follow the history and the role of Denmark in the NATO alliance and in other realms, based on that kind of personal curiosity. But my sense has been that they have been a real stalwart supporter of NATO throughout its existence, really, and have been among the first to step up in several of the conflicts in which the United States is putting together sort of multilateral forces and so on. And it, sometimes to the point of criticism, you know, those on, especially on the left, who don't like the quote unquote Washington consensus and the idea, you know, the historic idea that came out of, you know, George H.W. Bush about a unipolar world and kind of the U.S. ruling the oceans and so on. Denmark was too willing in some people's estimations, but they certainly have been there. And so now we have the situation where the United States is kind of given the back of the hand, I guess. Is that fair?
I think so. The Danes, in addition to being loyal allies and sort of the sense of making contributions, they also believe strongly in the values that underlie the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The preamble of the North Atlantic Treaty in 1949 specified that the alliance stood for democracy, individual liberty, and the rule of law. And the Danes really believe and take this seriously, and they believe that at this point the American administration is not necessarily serving as the sitting on the hill that Reagan used to talk about, providing guiding light for democracies everywhere. They see us as falling off from that kind of soft power leadership.
You know, this is so important, and this to me is really the crux of why I wanted you to be a guest on the show today, because we have a certain set of values that America traditionally has stood for in the world, at least ideally. Now, obviously, there's a lot of realpolitik that goes on, and there's a lot of, again, criticism from both the right and left of what the U.S. actually is doing versus what it says it's doing, and it's et cetera, et cetera. But on good days and in the ideal world, the United States has been a beacon for things like free speech. You know, the First Amendment to the Constitution talks about a tolerance for dissent, essentially. And here we have a person who is very well trained and schooled in all aspects relating to NATO, yourself, Stanley Sloan, and you are someone who is not afraid, it hasn't been afraid to speak out and say, I think the president is wrongheaded about certain aspects of his remarks and actions related to NATO. And so, again, ideally you'd say, well, this person doesn't like what the president is doing. Bring him to the conference, allow him to say that, get another speaker or two up there who are willing to defend what the president is doing, have the back and forth. This is called the discussion that you hope will lead to a quote-unquote more perfect union, elsewhere in the Constitution, that phrase, right?
I happen to believe in the value of debate and different perspectives.
Yeah.
And in fact, I've been doing public diplomacy speaking engagements for the State Department since the early 1980s. And the State Department has always respected the fact that its speakers may have different views than current administration policy. I've never found, in all of those years of speaking for the State Department, I've never had the experience where either an ambassador or an embassy decided that my criticism was something that they didn't want to put before foreign audiences. And I've always argued that that's a real strength of our democracy, is the fact that our government, through the State Department, has been willing to provide speakers to foreign audiences that demonstrate that we have different points of view, we can argue about them, and we have an effective democracy.
You know, that is the aura I think the United States wants to put out in front of an audience like this at a conference in Denmark or anywhere in Europe or anywhere in the world, really, is to go out there and say, we are strong enough and self-confident enough that we actually encourage criticism, because sometimes we can learn some things and improve our game. That's what it's all about. I mean, you know, again, that more perfect union phrase is really the sort of the push toward what people in the industry have called total quality improvement. You know, and that's been a key part of the country's strength over the couple centuries it's been in existence. And it really bothers me, frankly, to see it diminished, that principle diminished, this idea of encouraging criticism. And you know, from what I've seen I've actually been to a couple of conferences and so on where people from the State Department were speaking, and it almost seemed, I remember one when I was in Europe years and years ago, the goal seemed to be to actually purposely bring in people of different views and say, you know, here's view A and here's view B and let's have it out, kind of thing. And the idea that the United States of America could be a key sponsor of this event and willing to hear pretty diametrically opposed views on the topic at hand would be just something that I think other folks around the world really looked at that and said, "Wow, that's the sign of a strong country and a strong democracy that it's able and willing to do that." Do you think we're going to be able to get back there?
I hope so. I hope so. I think that a lot of damage has been done to both our democracy and also to our image overseas. What we call soft power, the ability to get people to follow us without coercing them, that soft power has been diminished dramatically during the Trump administration. We no longer have the trust, and it shows up in public opinion polls. So far, most governments are reluctant to criticize the administration, but even there at the meeting in London last week, it was obvious that there were these photo opportunities of several of the NATO heads of state joking about the president.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing truly diminishes our influence. It's not just a matter of image. It's a matter of whether people will be willing to follow us and accept our judgments.
What's at risk here? I mean, suppose the United States says, you know, who really cares about NATO anymore? It's getting old, and we can sort of really diminish our role in it, or even let it dissolve. Who cares? What's the problem with that?
Well, the problem is that we're talking about a world in which there still are threats. The Soviet Union is no longer around, but Russia definitely has been working against not only providing a fairly substantial military threat against the West, but also a political one as well, messing around in our elections and also messing around in European elections as well. We also have terrorism out there and a growing challenge from China. All of those things benefit our interests by cooperating with our NATO allies.
Yeah, obviously the world is still out there, folks, and I don't know. I've always taken a little bit of comfort in the idea that something like NATO was in business. So let's see what a listener out there has to say. Fred's on the line from Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey, there's an interesting theory as far as the State Department is concerned and the Defense Department. It's called the stability-instability paradox, and it seems to be working quite well right now. Do you think it will continue to work well?
What is the stability-instability paradox, Fred?
Okay, the major powers don't go to war with each other, but they have what they call proxy wars, Vietnam, Korea, Afghanistan, Nicaragua, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And your question again is what?
Do you think the instability paradox will continue?
What do you think about that, Stanley Sloan?
It's not exactly something that I have put a lot of focus on, but I think, yes, to some extent it will continue. And it's always a challenge for a major power to decide when it wants to maintain the current situation and what it wants to change. And sometimes the act of changing involves the use of force. Sometimes that works out, sometimes it doesn't.
If the major powers don't use force against each other.
They don't use force against each other, but they have these proxies that...
That's right.
Yeah.
And it definitely is a good thing that the United States and Soviet Union never use force against each other.
That is a good thing.
And then there's another theory out there. It's called a Thucydides paradox, and that is when one major power is threatened by another major power, will the threatened power attack the major power or its rival because it thinks it's getting too powerful? The Peloponnesian War was the result of that.
Well, that's certainly something that I frankly don't think we're going to get a real definite answer in the last minute or so that we have here of the segment of the show. But I thank you for the call, Fred. Provocative questions as always. Hey, I wanted to mention that we are coming up to the top of the hour. I want to first thank my guest very much, Stan Sloan, international expert on NATO, who really has been in the news this week. You can Google his name, Stanley Sloan, and you will get some interesting coverage, folks, from Washington Post, New York Times. And I'm going to monitor the situation over the next hour, which is usually my second hour here. We're going to go live to CBS News for the impeachment coverage. We may be ducking back in here later on in the hour for some more of the Dave Graham Show. We'll just have to see what unfolds. And be back with us on Monday we're going to have a visit with Mary Powell, the outgoing CEO of Green Mountain Power. So anyway, there you go, folks. We're going to a CBS News at the top of the hour here.
This is Jack from the Warren Store wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, continuing our program this morning on the Dave Graham Show. And we are going to be talking about the holidays and how women take on an awful lot of the burdens and chores and responsibilities, really, for keeping the holidays running smoothly in our families. And it really is quite something. I decided to get into this because I saw an article recently by a writer named Jenna Hartley, who was talking about emotional labor and the... emotional labor is actually sort of taking on the responsibility for a wide variety of thinking about chores. Never mind the chores. I mean, people have done studies forever about how women do a lot of the housework and the cooking and the childcare, et cetera, et cetera. But emotional labor actually is the planning for all of that and the thinking about it and the time it takes actually to make the list before you actually go out and buy the stuff on the list, for instance, just for one of a myriad examples. And around the holidays, this seems to be a time of year when a lot of these issues are very much stepped up, shall we say. And I have an expert on how this plays out in the retail sector, and that would be Kathy Murphy. And she is the proprietor of the Stowe Street Emporium right here in Waterbury, our good friend and neighbor just down the street from the WDEV studios. And she is with us this morning in the studio. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. And there's no better friend to us than WDEV. So thank you, Dave.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. I think you came in last year just to talk to us about the general scene of the retail season.
Yes.
in the big Black Friday, et cetera, season here that we get into this time of year.
Yes.
This year I saw this article, Jenna Hartley's piece on emotional labor, and it struck me that Boy, you know, it really is true when you look around. And in fact, I was talking to a good friend and colleague last week. I said, you know, I sort of jokingly asked him, I said, have you done all of your Christmas shopping? And he said, you know, my wife said to me, well, you only have to buy one thing, meaning for her.
It's true.
She goes out and she does all the shopping for the rest of the family. And I kind of went, ding, that's a topic for a show.
Right. Good one.
So Kathy, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I appreciate you stopping by.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And I believe we do have on the phone with us also Lisa Senecal. She is the chair of the Vermont Commission on Women. Is that right, Lisa?
I am here.
Excellent. I'm glad we were able to connect with you this morning. It's been quite an adventure just to do that. So we could talk about those details at some other juncture. But Lisa, I wanted to start with you. I think I sent you a link to this article last week about emotional labor. Did you have a chance to look at that at all?
I did. And it's, you know, you won't be surprised that it's a topic of conversation both within the commission and among women on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a tough article for me to read, just because I'm sort of thinking about how this kind of stuff has played out in my own life and so on and so forth. I think it really did raise some crucial issues about, you know, as I was saying, I don't know if you heard the little intro a minute ago, but I was talking about how there have been a lot of studies, you know, in books and so on. I remember there was a book called The Second Shift that was probably 20 years old now or more, talking about how women in, you know, you have now sort of households in which many times both spouses are working full time and they're trying to run a household also. But a lot of that work of running the household, of just doing the chores, the laundry, the childcare, the cooking, the cleaning, et cetera, tend to fall to women still, you know, as if these old traditional roles have not gone away completely or have not transitioned to an equal sharing by men and women. But this article really focused beyond that on the sort of thinking about the stuff, the actual, you know, how do you, it's not just a matter of cleaning the closet, but it's actually figuring out, you know, where stuff is going to go when you do clean the closet and that sort of thing. Is this, in your estimation, do you hear more about this time of year with the holiday, all the holiday shopping and preparations and card writing going on?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, there's so many different elements to it. You know, women still end up taking on the bulk of responsibility for not just caring for children and all that goes along with that, but women who are in the sandwich generation are also taking care of elderly parents and, you know, other relatives, and that becomes even more important, you know, responsibility to make sure that the holidays remain special for those folks, but it creates a tremendous additional burden when you're already taking on all the extra cooking and cleaning and holiday parties and, yes, the cards, but, you know, all the increased stuff that happens, especially in elementary age children's lives.
Yeah.
You know, they're having school parties, they're having, you know, extra gatherings. You've got the extra gatherings for adult commitments that you have, both just social and additional work. And I know I have, you know, the parties are wonderful, but board commitments that you end up having layered onto that. So, yeah, it's a lot of extra work for women during the holiday season that unfortunately not only raises stress levels for women this time of year, but it also sucks some of the joy out of the holidays. And that has, you know, I think all of us, if we take a step back and think about our childhoods, the things that we remember, the time that we spent with family and friends, and if that time ends up being marred with parents, particularly moms, being incredibly stressed out, that has a negative impact on the holidays overall. It's just less fun for everyone if you're being frayed to the point that they know you're not enjoying it, and it's creating stress within the family.
all that peace and joy stuff kind of starts to diminish somewhat.
It does.
Yeah, that is too bad. We're going to be going shortly to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News, but I want to talk afterward about maybe what you might suggest for that men would want to think about doing to help to spread the work, and then, you know, by extension, spread the joy, because you know, this is supposed to be a time for sharing and caring this time of year. Kathy Murphy, we were talking last week when I was recruiting you to come on the show today, and you were telling me that about 75% of the people who come into your store, the Stowe Street Emporium here on Stowe Street in Waterbury, are in fact female.
They are female, but I would say if it's only female, it's probably more like 80-85%, because of course women come in with their partners, mm-hmm. and the best is when they leave them at the pub and they get to come in themselves and relax and yeah. shop at leisure. So that stress that Lisa was just talking about isn't prevalent.
Yeah, it's sort of like, honey, you go get a beer, I'm going to go shopping.
Well, it's funny, in our store we do have a men's shirt rack, Prana and Lucky Brand shirts, but we really call our men's department the two yummy chairs that we have for the guys to hang out in while their female partners are
that is the other
doing
trick.
Their thing.
That's the other trick. So the guy actually goes into the store. What a
yeah.
guy.
Yeah.
And but then he ends up sitting in the comfy chair while yes. while his wife wanders around the store.
Yes.
Still checking the list and looking for what to buy and
correct.
All that sort of stuff.
Correct.
Are the guys sheepish about this at all, or is it just?
Well, you know, I don't want to sound stereotypical either for the guys out there, but I have had some come in, you know, and they're actually carrying the list. The guys are carrying the list, and we can pick that up.
Yeah, let's
as
do
soon
that
as we're done with our break.
we're going to go to some CBS News at the bottom of the hour here, and when we return, we're going to continue our conversation about the load on women around the holidays. We'll be back, folks.
This is Jack from the Warren Store wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
We are back and we are continuing our conversation about the load of stress and work and chores and preparations, et cetera, loaded onto women at this time of year. It seems much more so than men, and we have a couple of people who, I think the big picture view, and also we're going to get some small picture view, I think, in a moment from Lisa Senecal. She's the chair of the Vermont Commission on Women. And Kathy Murphy is proprietor of the Stowe Street Emporium here in Montpelier. Terrific little shop.
Waterbury.
I'm sorry?
Waterbury.
What did I say, Montpelier?
Yeah.
I'm still half asleep, folks. Sorry. We are in Waterbury, and Stowe Street is in Waterbury, and the Stowe Street Emporium is in Waterbury. Okay, now I've said it three times. I should be able to get it right for the rest of the show. The Stowe Street Emporium in Waterbury, where Kathy Murphy is the proprietor, and you are someone who is up close and personal to the shopping habits of men and women. And I wanted to check in with you, Kathy, because you were saying that you know, men come into the shop, and there's this phenomenon where the gender prevalence may change for just one day.
Oh, usually Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve. What happens on Christmas Eve?
Well, that's the last minute. Hurrah. Panic sets in.
And it's all the guys who come in and say, oh, my God.
Yeah.
My wife's been shopping since August, and
right,
here I am.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Get it done in one fell swoop.
Yep.
So it's
yep.
fine with us. We love it. But we do find that men are more acceptable to have help right away, which is awesome. They'll come in and ask for advice and suggestions, which, of course, we're always happy to give and do. So,
but isn't that and you and would, is it fair to say the majority of the staff in the store are female?
Yes.
Okay. So here again, I just want to point out that what's going on there, it sounds like, is these guys are coming in and saying, oh, I'm clueless. I need some help. And women step up and think through what they need to be thinking about.
Sure, sure. Right?
I think we're continuing some kind of a pattern here. But
right. They come in with their kids, and the kids really like to help dad pick out gifts too. So
Lisa Senecal is the chair of the Vermont Commission on Women, and Lisa, you look at these at a lot of issues related to gender relations, from sort of a big picture theoretical perspective, I'm sure, and you're well read on these topics. But you also mentioned to me when we were talking about scheduling this program that you have some experience in retail yourself. Is that right?
Yeah, I worked in retail. Excuse me, all through high school and then off and on during college. And I worked at a department store, and I had absolutely the same experience on Christmas Eve, working primarily in the women's department. It was desperate men coming in who didn't have clear ideas. They also didn't have sizes, which was always interesting. And I would ask, what size does your wife or your girlfriend wear? And they would get a dumbstruck look on their faces, like it hadn't occurred to them that that might be information that would be important when they went clothes shopping. And they would look at me and say, well, she's about your size.
Yep.
And then after the holidays, the boxes would come back now in the hands of wives and girlfriends.
Yeah, yeah.
Who clearly were not about my size, and the men were just happy to have anything in a box that we would also wrap for them, and didn't want to show up empty-handed on Christmas morning.
Oh my gosh, so true, Lisa. We experienced that same thing. So
I got to say, I'm getting more and more embarrassed here as a member of the male side of the species here, because this is embarrassing. I got to say, I mean, come on, guys, what is up with this? I mean, let me have you give your pitch here, Lisa. You're talking to men now. What do you want to say to them about all this?
Give a little thought to it in advance, but I would say that the gift giving is the least of what you could do to help participate. Ask the women in your lives what they have going on between now and Christmas or during Hanukkah, whatever holiday it is you celebrate in your family, and start getting a real idea of what it is additional that are on these women's lists to do, and then sit down and take 20 minutes to figure out how you might take on some of those things on the list and take some of the burden off, a person you care about deeply. And I don't think men don't want the women in their lives to enjoy the holidays. I think they have a tendency, to a large degree, to not be aware of just how much additional burden is on women this time of year. And it's also partially, women's responsibility to say, hey, look, here's the list that I have of everything I have to do between now and the 25th.
Yep.
So let's sit down and see how we can split this up.
Parcel some of this out because it's a long list.
I think I love all that, Lisa. You're so on point. And I feel like men view shopping more as a necessity and women view it more as an event or an experience, except for maybe this time of year. When they do feel the burden of getting everything done, so
going through the list.
Yes.
Let me say something that's going to sound stupid and guy-like, and shoot this down because I mean obviously there's got to be some kind of a response to it. But I mean I hear some men. I mean I had a conversation months ago about this whole just emotional labor in general with a couple of other guys, and one was saying something like, well, women worry about what order the knickknacks go in, and men worry about whether their favorite basketball team is going to sharpen up on its own defense. And and these are just two different realms. And so in terms of the actual mental energy that gets devoted to these different topics, that's just kind of the way it breaks down. And what are we going to do about it sort of thing? So, Lisa, tackle that one.
Well, first, I would say as a sports-loving woman that we also carry that weight of worrying about how our teams are doing this time of year. But beyond that, I think it's important for, you know, there's a nugget of something really important in what you said that man's response was. And I women have been programmed, and the programming is ongoing on the covers of magazines and on Instagram and, you know, checking out other people's social media and seeing all the, you know, wonderful things they seem to be doing to create the perfect Christmas. And, you know, why am I not able to do more? And shouldn't I be doing this? And I think we have to look at the things that we place on ourselves and what we feel we're responsible for doing, and start looking at what's truly important to be done and what is just additional stuff that we've bought into that isn't really necessary, but we take it on anyway. So, you know, there does have to be some reevaluation, I think, of our capacity to do things and the importance of doing various things. I think we have a tendency to think that, you know, other people have expectations of us that if we didn't meet, it would be okay. Christmas would still come, Hanukkah would still come, and people would still love us. And it's right if we don't do it all.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective, actually. I mean, some of this, it does sound like, not that women necessarily should be assigned yet another task, but if they were to take on a new task, it might be to figure out tasks they can shed.
Yes, yeah, I think we can be kind to ourselves, and not everything is going to be the difference between whether or not the holidays are wonderful for everyone or not. And we have to figure out what is and what isn't important.
I asked two young men about Christmas and this whole topic just the other day, and one gets a lump of coal in his stocking with this response. He said, "Christmas is stupid, and if women want to take that on themselves, I'm not going to feel too badly about it."
Oh,
ooh,
no.
That's ouch. Yeah, ouch is right. Kathy, what do you think of that as a response?
Wow, that's a big lump of coal in his stocking for sure.
Okay.
You know, of course, I'm coming from a retail perspective, when I hear statements like that, I fear the downfall
of
my store and the industry, because without women right now, stores like mine would probably collapse. So,
from that practical perspective, these are pretty crucial issues,
it
I would guess.
It has to be communities, and that involves men and women. So
that is the case, folks. Here's another response I got, which I just have to repeat because I thought it was kind of hilarious. This other guy said, "The work is actually equally divided between the sexes. It's just that men give all their work to one guy and his reindeer." I don't know. I'm going to bring in my good friend Dana Jewell here, because I got to blame him. He's the one who got me onto this. He's our producer. He's also a news guy here. He's a man who wears many hats here at WDEB. One of them last week was my interlocutor when we were talking about this. I almost half jokingly said, "So Dana, are you all set with your Christmas shopping?" And he said, "Well, my wife told me, you know, you only have to get one thing."
Yeah.
Meaning, of course, a present for her, and she's shopping up for probably the rest of the family and the extended family, et cetera.
Yeah, but she also made me feel like I was the last person in the world that did that.
Ah, okay. That's important. That's important.
There's strength in numbers. You
the
know,
figure is
we're all
the
same.
Yeah. You're the one guy who has this habit of terrible thing, and you better straighten up and fly right.
I'm going to get it all done next week.
Okay, that's good. That's good. And I after that, I felt so guilty. I actually went out and did a little Christmas shopping myself this past weekend.
Good man.
And So there you go. I mean, it is possible, guys. It is possible out there. I am going to thank my two guests very much for coming in. Actually, Lisa Senecal's been on the phone, the chair of the Vermont Commission on Women, for sharing some thoughts about this issue of the extra burdens taken on by women during the holiday season. Of course, it's year-round, but it seems to really step up during the holidays. And what can I say other than, guys, we need to step up ourselves, our own game a little bit here. Kathy Murphy also has been my guest here in the studio. She only had to come 100 yards down the street from our neighbors, the Stowe Street Emporium here in Waterbury. And it's great to see you, Kathy, as well.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I wish you both very happy holidays, by the way. And do get some relaxation time, please. I really want you to both and all the folks out there to do that. It's not all about just getting the shopping done.
And wow, Lisa, I want to meet you.
Yeah, we'll work that out next time.
You're over in Waterbury.
You have a fantastic store, and I encourage everybody to stop in. It's really wonderful.
Thank you very much.
All righty,
Dave.
There we go. So we're going to shift gears now because I did want to get a little bit more thinking and talking about this news event today where the House Judiciary Committee voted two articles of impeachment against the President of the United States. And with us to join us this morning is Bob Ney, one of our commentators, national commentators. He was with Talk Media News for a long time. He's now out as a freelance commentator on the scene around the national news. And Bob, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
How are you doing?
I am doing okay, just waiting for Christmas.
Yeah. Now, don't just wait. You got to get out there and actually do some. You're a guy. You need to get out there and do some shopping and ask your wife. Oh. You know, hey, can I help out with what part of the meal can I prepare? And
I don't like the elbows and things. I'll do mine online this year, probably.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah, that's the other way to go. Well, hey Bob, I wanted to check in with you because obviously big news this morning, and you are. You are, I'm sure, watching it very, very closely. What are your thoughts?
Well, they had a 14-hour marathon yesterday. A little bit of inside baseball. I always like to bring these things out.
Yeah.
There was a White House Christmas party, and they the members saw that they were going to be missing it because the hearing was, quote, drug out, according to the Republicans, because they said Chairman Nadler wanted more primetime exposure. So as a result, they drug it out longer since they had to miss the Christmas party. It went on for 14 hours. So that's a little bit of inside personal stuff I think the listeners might want to know. It doesn't count for anything, but that's the way it is in D.C. So it went a long time, and then today's the official movement on it. And then it goes to the House floor. He'll be impeached, I think, with no Republican votes. And then the end result is going to be the Senate. And the big thing in the Senate, Dave, is pretty simple. Are they going to dispose of it fast, or are they going to drag it out? The president, by the way, sort of wants it drug out, believe it or not.
Huh. The president actually is... he was saying last week, or tweeting last week, I guess is the best way to describe it, that he wanted a fast result in the Senate. On the other hand, I think on some days he wants to get into bringing in the Bidens and anybody else he thinks might come in for some embarrassment or something. What's the current reading here of what he wants?
Well, everybody's talking on the Republican side about bringing in the Bidens, but the Bidens have no relevancy whatsoever. Let's hypothetically, I just wanted to stress hypothetically here so nobody listening kind of goes wild on you. Let's say hypothetically that Hunter Biden was wrong in everything he did in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. Shouldn't have been there, shouldn't have even pointed to the Ukraine on the map, hypothetically.
Yep. Okay.
That still raises the question, though, does the President of the United States have the right or the ability to bring up, this in a conversation with another foreign president and the suspicion of linking it to foreign aid? So no matter what Biden would have done or did not do, it has no relevancy to the call. It doesn't. And it shouldn't. So I don't see the benefit of bringing Hunter Biden in there except politically to damage Joe Biden.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to play the devil's advocate here a little bit with you just for a moment. And you're a former Republican member of Congress, and I'm somebody whose listeners occasionally accuse me of being too liberal. This is kind of ironic here, but I'm going to push the.
You're going to defend Trump here somehow.
Well, I'm going to push maybe the Jim Jordan, Doug Collins line here for a moment.
And
it would be like this that if Hunter Biden did do something worthy of investigating. And did something wrong, and the president of the United States, as head of the executive branch, which does include law enforcement, calls up the head of another country and says, "Hey, we have this investigation that we want to launch into X. Can you help us out with our investigation of X?" The Collins, Jordan, et cetera line seems to be that's quite all right.
But see, there's the problem. I think is that if in fact that was a scenario with Hunter Biden, then I think that the State Department would have every right to be able to mention this, that it should be looked at, and mention it to the president of the Ukraine's top staff. Our State Department should be able to mention it, as long as there's no tie to foreign aid. And I'll give you the best example in the world. I have been on, 30 congressional trips where at least on those 30 trips, somebody from the congressional side, Democrat and Republican, have mentioned to foreign leaders and everything else under the sun that, we have interests. If you continue to do this, we may look at not supporting you,
right.
We have interests. Where do you stand on Israel? Where do you stand on Cuba? So I've seen that 100 times happen.
Sure.
So I think that the State Department could have done it. I just think the president himself, it's off color for him to do it. Now, the big question is, did he tie a quid pro quo? Can they prove that to cutting foreign aid? That's just the question, I think, out there that people are going to have to resolve in their minds.
Yeah, I think that really is a key question here. It has been pretty well resolved in my own mind. I'm not letting the president off the hook here, and I don't want people to think that I am all of a sudden doing that. Because, if you think about this, imagine if there were actually a legitimate investigation of some U.S. person that encompassed another country. This would never rise to the level of any part of a conversation between the two presidents of the United States and that country.
Correct.
It would be handled maybe by the FBI, maybe by, if it were a drug thing, the DEA would be doing something, maybe by the State Department if it involved, some kind of counterintelligence thing. There's just so many levels that you would be handling this way below where the president operates. It's a mind-boggling jump to think that all of a sudden the president of the United States is going to get on the phone and ask for an investigation of somebody who got a cushy sinecure job. That is just not even really in the realm.
I think the answer is, was there a quid pro quo? And they haven't been able to establish it. Look, I think the call was uncalled for. I don't think the president should have mentioned anything about his opponent on the call. But they still don't have the nail down where somebody says, the president ordered me to cut the foreign aid. I think it was bizarre that the president said, I told them no quid pro quo. He just said that to protect himself. But the question remains, people believe it's a quid pro quo. Can they prove it's a quid pro quo? Now, if they had the president under oath, that's a whole different world, because that's what happened to Bill Clinton. He got under oath,
That's true.
He shouldn't have had to at the time, but he did.
No, that is true, and the failure to get the president under oath, I think, was a key failing on the part of the Mueller investigation. Frankly,
Mueller, absolutely.
That's where it should have happened. I do want to roll the clock back. Speaking of all that, because and it's not that back that far, but let's think back to the phrase "individual one" for a moment, and refresh us on what that was.
You mean with
Michael Cohen ends up in jail.
The guy
he's allegedly conspiring with is
right.
The president of the United States, right?
Yes, individual one. Right?
Yes, yes. I still can't understand why the Democrats. I mean, if you think this one's a little thin, this phone call to the president of Ukraine is a little thin. Individual one, I think, in terms of actual, a real criminal nexus here, is thicker, isn't it?
I do too. I think they had more to hang on. The other thing too. Now, this is a pure political debate of what I'm about to say, but I think the Democratic side should have done everything under the sun during this impeachment. Everything under the sun.
Yep.
To drag Rudy Giuliani to the table. Publicly.
Yes.
Everything.
Yeah.
And they didn't. And I know why they didn't. It's because they didn't want to go into 2020. Rudy would have fought it. They would have had to go to court battles. They didn't want to go into 2020, with all of this out there.
Yeah.
But I think Rudy Giuliani could have led to, who did he talk to on whose behalf? Did he talk to anybody about the foreign aid? Did he talk to anybody in Ukraine about foreign aid? I mean, I think that could have been. I mean, I don't know. I'm not saying that's the outcome it would have been, but I surely think that Rudy Giuliani would have been a treasure trove full of information.
Rudy Giuliani would have been, and a lot of woulda, shoulda, couldas, I'll tell you, in connection with this whole thing. And we'll have to let the historians deal with that. We got to go to the end of the show here on this Friday morning.
Thanks,
Bob,
Dave.
Nate, thanks so much for joining me this morning. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
That's about it for the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV FM and AM. Tune in again Monday morning. We're going to have Mary Powell, the outgoing chief executive of Green Mountain Power, on. And don't forget to stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, and the Midday News Service. Have a great weekend, everybody.